Hello and welcome to our London History Podcast, where we share our love of London, its people, places and history. It's designed for you to learn things about London that most Londoners don't even know. I am your host, Hazel Baker, qualified London tour guide and CEO and founder of londonguidedwalks.co.uk. Each episode is supported by show notes, transcripts, photos and further reading, all to be found on our website. Click on londonguidedwalks.co.uk, podcast, and then select the episode that you fancy. And if you enjoy what we do, then you'll love our guided walks and private tours that we offer throughout the year. So get that cup of tea, put your feet up and enjoy. Joining me in the studio today is City of London tour guide Ian McDermott. Hello.
Hello, Hazel.
So today we're going to be focusing on the Tudor period and more specifically during the reign of Henry VIII. The area that we're going to be talking about is now considered to be Zone 2 in London, but it wasn't considered London at all in the Tudor period.
Yes, we're talking about Deptford, and in 1513, Henry VIII establishes a royal dockyard at Deptford, and he also establishes one pretty much the same time at Woolwich. And these are enormously important. The first royal dockyard is established by Henry VIII's father, Henry VII, at Portsmouth, but these are the first dockyards built on the Thames. And in the course of the 16th century, Deptford becomes the largest dockyard in the country. And one of the reasons that Deptford is chosen is that between Deptford and Woolwich is the Royal Palace of Greenwich, and therefore it's an easy place for Henry VIII to get to, easy to get to particularly when he's staying in his palace at Greenwich, but also easy to get to because it's along the Thames if he's somewhere else in London. So it's very easy for him to keep an eye on. And he also establishes about the same time the Royal Ordnance at Woolwich as well. And you have here, with these two sites at Woolwich and the dockyard at Deptford, the establishment of a large naval industrial complex, which is of enormous importance. And these developments are partly because Henry VIII really is the first monarch to have a permanent navy. And a lot of writers, when they're writing naval history, they see Henry VIII as the father of the modern British Navy. One of the significant things is that Henry VIII spends a lot of money on his navy. He has, in relative terms, relative to what's been before, a lot of ships. And this diminishes a little after his death, but not significantly. And then, of course, under Elizabeth, there's this important naval conflict with the Spanish. One unfortunate thing for these people arguing for the origins of the modern navy is the fact that things rather go into reverse in the early 17th century. But nevertheless, this is a clear break with the past. And in particular, medieval kings would often construct ships just for a particular campaign. And then once that campaign was over with, I'm thinking perhaps of Henry V, when he and the campaign that leads to Agincourt. Once that campaign is over, the ships are decommissioned, sold, or even broken up.
And were these dry docks?
Well, it's at this time that you get the construction of the first dry dock. So the first dry dock is built by Henry VII at Portsmouth. And then Henry VIII in 1513 builds one new dry dock at Deptford and another one at Woolwich. And this is very significant because before this date, if you wanted to repair a ship, what you would do is you would, at high tide, drag the ship as far up the riverbank as you possibly could, and then very probably create some kind of barrier against the incoming tide using bits of wood and earth. And that was the standard way of proceeding. And when you get dry docks, they are obviously a lot more convenient. They're a lot more, makes repairing a ship a lot easier. They are, however, very, very expensive. And one other constraint on them is that they, at this period, they can only take one ship at a time. And Henry, in 1513, he establishes a dry dock at Deptford. He establishes a huge storehouse, and then these facilities are gradually added to. And in particular, in 1517, they build what is known as the Great Pond, which is a wet dock which can contain five ships at a time. So this is an absolutely huge thing. And these facilities are gradually added to. One of Henry's innovations, I was talking about him being seen as the father of the modern navy. It's not just simply having a large number of ships. It's also at the end of Henry's reign, it can be argued that he puts in place the bureaucracy. So when we talk about a modern, when we talk about a navy or an army, we're talking about a permanent organization. And in the 1540s, he creates the Council for Marine Causes. And this is a kind of the beginnings of a bureaucracy running the Navy. So he's he can be seen as the creator of the modern Navy in two senses. And that has its heart at Deptford. So the Treasurer's House is at Deptford. And this is a house that's later lived in by Sir John Hawkins. And there is also a building there for the clerks of this committee to inhabit. So you'll be getting the development of a complex at Deptford. And when we're mentioning Woolwich as well, it's important that also in 1513, Henry VIII founds the Royal Ordnance at Woolwich. So Woolwich is divided up into the eastern part of it, which is where the ordnance is, and then the western part, the bit nearer to Greenwich and Deptford, which is where the royal dockyards are. And you can see that you're getting the development of a naval complex here. And this is by far and away the largest industrial complex in early modern England. And after our period, it'll expand enormously, especially in the 18th century. It becomes absolutely vast. But really throughout this period, up until England industrialises, this is the largest concentration of industrial activity. And it's not just the Woolwich and Deptford and Greenwich. They also are taking activity. They're building docks. They're repairing ships at other places along the river, like Erith, for example. So it's a huge, huge undertaking.
And why these particular places?
Well, partly because the palace is there at Greenwich. Also, it's obviously convenient with the river. It's very convenient to move ships along. Well, reasonably convenient to move ships along. One thing about the Thames at this time is that it can accommodate the largest ships in existence. And it's also extremely convenient for communications because of the river. One of the things that you have to do with navies is you have to victual them. You have to make sure that the men on board have sufficient to eat and drink, and they also need supplies of ammunition and things. And the victualling is absolutely huge. You're talking about vast amounts of salted meat, salted fish, ship's biscuits, fresh water, and above all, beer. And all of this has to be supplied. And obviously, the one place in England that can provide victuals for a navy is London. And even when the ships depart from bases outside London, and in particular Portsmouth, the victuals will still be sent by ship from London. That's for when you're sending a ship out to sea when it's all ready. But also you need to repair the ships and you need to build the ships. And obviously they take vast amounts of timber. The structure of the ship is made of oak, and the planks that they use for oak are enormously thick for the hulls, but also for the decking. And you need to have a reasonable supply of timber, which you've got in southern England because of Kent. And there's an area, again, now southeast London, just about, named Pett's Woods. Mm-hmm. The Petts were a shipbuilding family who owned the wood, and the wood comes named after them, I think, a bit later in the 16th century. So you've got that supply of oak. But also you've got the other timber that you need for the masts and yard arms, which is fir and spruce. And you also need sail cloth. You need pitch and tar for caulking the ships. And all of these things are imported. And the ropes as well. So in the 15th century, they make ropes in Dorset. But by this time, the ropes imported. It's obviously just a lot more efficient, a lot cheaper to import rope from the Baltic than to have it made in England. And if you're importing things, then obviously being on the Thames is an ideal place. And a lot of these Baltic goods, as we were mentioning when we were talking about the Elizabethan docks, beginning with this period, is the huge importance of Antwerp and the convenience for London from getting to and from Antwerp. So all of these factors feed into why the Thames is very, very convenient. And one might also add that there's a kind of specialisation. Deptford is hugely important because in the course of the 16th century, it becomes by far and away the largest naval dockyard. So hugely important. But when England is at war, the ships tend to depart from Portsmouth. So Portsmouth is the kind of forward base. And when England is at war, things get concentrated on Portsmouth. But when she's at peace and when you're maintaining the ships, building ships, then it's the Thames and in particular Deptford, which is more important. And this is obviously because it's a lot easier to defend the Thames. You're further away from your enemy, so it's kind of safer to do the maintenance and the shipbuilding there. There are a couple of disadvantages to the Thames. One is that if you get an unfavourable wind, you can be stuck for ages trying to make your way up to London at this period. I mean, it can actually take weeks to get from the mouth of the estuary to London if you're unlucky. The other thing is that the Thames obviously is a river, and when you're at Deptford, the water can actually be quite fresh. So, and fresh water, timber rots a lot more quickly in fresh water than it does in salt water. So it's not great. It has disadvantages for keeping ships in. And talking about rotting of timbers, at this period, the ships need to be repaired, maintained at least once every 2 years, and they recognise this. And this is partly because when they are in slightly warmish waters, the timbers will be eaten away by worms. You'll get all kinds of rubbish growing on the bottom of the hulls of the ships, which needs to be cleaned, and you just need to undertake general maintenance. And you've got this general threat of wood rotting. So they are very, very expensive things to keep, and you need to be able to provide them with regular maintenance, and hence the importance of these dockyards.
And I suppose the number of people that have the skill, that London's going to be the place for that as well.
Yes, so shipwrights are enormously skilled, and once you've got a sort of centre of these things, you've got the pool of labour there that you can bring in, and you've also got the pool of all the other craftsmen that you can draw on for all the sort of ancillary services.
And what's Henry doing, getting involved with all of these ships and that anyway? What's he trying to achieve?
Well, I think there are two things behind the creation of a standing navy. One is Henry VIII's own interest in military affairs, military in general. So he spends a lot of his reign at war. And he's primarily interested in fighting on horseback, in a kind of fulfilling a chivalric ideal. But he's also fascinated by what we would regard as modern technology. And these ships can be seen as huge status symbols. One of the ships that is constructed at Woolwich at the beginning of his reign is the Henry Grâce à Dieu, which is a remarkable ship. 1,500 tons. When we were talking about the Elizabethan dockyards the other week, I think I mentioned that a lot of the ships docking in London for commercial purposes were between 60, maybe 80 tons. So this is 1,500. It's absolutely enormous. And I think this vessel was partly a sort of big vanity project on the part of Henry VIII.
And when we say tons, what do we mean?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Unfortunately, when you read tons, it's often spelt T-O-N-S, And it shouldn't be confused with the modern use of tons. When we talk about a ship's displacement, it's done in tonnage now, and that's the amount of water displaced by the hull measured in tons, T-O-N-S. Whereas the Tudor period, it really should be spelt T-U-N-S, and it was a hypothetical measure of the volume of how many tons the ship's hull could hold. So you can't compare really Tudor tons with modern tons. But 1500 is obviously, compared to these the standard size of a commercial vessel, about 60 tons. I mean, it's absolutely huge.
And when we're talking about Henry VIII and his ego, I mean, there's a price that has to be paid, not just in life lost, but where's the money coming from for this?
Yeah, well, this is one of the extraordinary things about Henry VIII's reign. I think in general, when you read about Henry VIII and people take a critical attitude towards him, they concentrate either on the Reformation, and certain writers dislike the Reformation, perhaps coming in from a Catholic point of view and seeing it as the willful destruction of a religion which fulfilled the needs of popular piety. That's a kind of controversial thing, but certain critics of Henry VIII come at it from that angle. And others focus on his great personal cruelty, and in particular his predisposition to have those quite close to him executed. But the other thing that really strikes me about Henry VIII's reign is how wasteful it was. I mean, he spends a huge amount of money on fighting. And not only is this a waste in a kind of contemporary 21st century, rather unhistorical thing of decrying warfare, but it was wasteful in his own terms, because he achieves very, very little. Now, I don't think he saw it that way, and he was certainly very keen to talk up his military prowess. But the two big achievements, in inverted commas, of his reign on a military point of view are the Battle of the Spurs in 1513, which is basically described by historians as a cavalry skirmish, and which, incidentally, is totally overshadowed by the Battle of Flodden in the same year, which is fought by Thomas Howard and not by Henry. And Flodden is a massive victory over the Scots. And as I say, Henry's not there. And then at the end of the reign, he captures Boulogne in this great victory, supposedly against the French. But pretty much immediately after its capture, his council is discussing how on earth can we get rid of Boulogne? It's costing so much money to provision. So there's very little return for all of this expenditure. And we should mention that this expenditure, Henry VIII gets into debt because of this. And he's also dissolved the monasteries. And he's used the resources from that dissolution partly to finance these wars. And there's very, very little return on it. But one of the things, he spends a huge amount of money fighting. I think the figures are, in the 1540s, when he goes to war, he spends a total of £2 million, absolutely huge, in his final wars. And of that 2 million, about a tenth, 200,000, goes on the Navy. And this is a constant refrain about the Navy, is that it's that's very important in English history, is that fighting naval wars is so much cheaper than fighting wars on land. But it's still a huge, huge expense. These ships are hugely expensive. The crewing of them is a huge expense. All the supplies, provisions, it's enormously expensive.
So if we go back to Deptford and why Deptford, where does it get its name from?
Well, there are two crucial aspects to the geography of what is now South East London, but was then a series of villages. One is the River Thames itself, which we've been talking about, which obviously is a hugely important means of communication. But the other thing is the old Roman road of Watling Street, which connects Dover with London and then goes, in theory, over London Bridge and up into Staffordshire. And Watling Street at this time is the old Dover Road, and it runs fairly close to the river. All of this area is marshy, so when the Romans build their road, they build it up on a kind of embankment. And then when it gets to Deptford, it has to cross the River Ravensbourne, and the end of the River Ravensbourne, when it flows into the Thames, is known as Deptford Creek. And it was at Deptford that the ford was, and I suspect the clue's in the name. deep ford, i.e. it wasn't an easy ford to cross, particularly at high tide. And one of the remarkable things when you're modern Deptford, when you go through it on the railway, is looking at Deptford Creek and how dramatic the difference is between low tide and high tide. At low tide, it looks like a little trickle. And then at high tide, it really is a very high river. And I think the difference between high and low tide is around 18 feet normally, and it can go a lot higher than that around this part of the Thames. So it's quite dramatic.
Yeah, you can see it on the railway bridge, can't you?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yesterday I went in to London at low tide and came back at high tide, and it never ceases to fascinate me.
Brilliant. Now, you mentioned about this pond that they built in 1517. So let's go into that. What was it?
Yeah, so the key thing, 1513, Henry VIII established it. He builds a dry dock, and then he builds a huge, huge storehouse. And then these facilities are added to, and in 1517, they build the pond, or Great Pond as it's known. And this was a wet dock, and by the standards of the time, it was enormous. So it could hold 5 ships in it at least. So a huge, huge undertaking. And then the facilities at Deptford are gradually extended. They build other storage facilities. The treasurer's house, this is the treasurer of the Navy. His house is built in the 1540s, and it becomes the heart of a industrial naval complex. I was saying earlier that Henry VIII is often regarded as the founder of the modern navy, and I've alluded to one reason for this is that under him, for the first time, England acquires a standing navy. But he's also, historians, when they look back and they want to see the creation of the modern navy, they look at his bureaucratic reforms. And in particular, in the 1540s, he creates something known as the Council of the Marine, or sometimes it's known as Council for Marine Causes. And this is seen as the first time that there's a permanent bureaucracy. There are officials in charge of the various aspects of the Navy. So, for example, one of them is in charge of ordnance, and it's a permanent body, as opposed to it being under the charge of Wolsey or Cromwell and then sort of dealing with everything. Here, for the first time, you've got a dedicated council dealing with naval administration. And one aspect of this is that they acquire a new house for their clerks. And where do they do that? It's at Deptford.
Right. So you were speaking about Deptford. The listeners have put Deptford in their city mapper on their Google Maps, ready to plan their day to look at these royal dockyards. What is there to see?
Well, unfortunately, of the Tudor period, it can be answered very quickly, absolutely nothing. And indeed, at Deptford, it's quite hard to see anything, because where the Tudor dockyards were is now known as Convoy's Wharf, which is a modern name. And since about 2000, this has been a site that's been assigned for modern development. It's owned by a Hong Kong developer, Hutchison, and they've been in dispute with Lewisham Council trying to get planning permission to put up blocks of flats. And there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, but a lot of the up until now, the planning permission has been refused because the council thought that the developer was not paying sufficient attention to the enormous historical importance of the site, and they wanted the development to make some kind of nod towards the history, not just the Tudor history, but the later history as well. I might add that at this point, Deptford is a dockyard, as is Woolwich, right up until 1869. And I was saying there's none of the Tudor remains there, but there are sort of, in the archaeology, there are later dockyards. One of the problems is that the Tudor dockyards became subsumed within the later dockyards, so there's nothing there in the archaeology.
Oh, I was going to say, what about that storehouse that
yes,
you mentioned?
Yes, good. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. this is a remarkable story. So I mentioned this huge, huge Tudor storehouse. That was actually intact until 1952, and the Admiralty knocked it down. It beggars belief. But because it was knocked down fairly recently, the archaeology of its foundations was fairly complete. So that's had the proper attention from our archaeologists. And what you can do now, Convoys Wharf, you can walk around the edge of it and you can peer through security gates. The latest development, they've got a notice up saying piling has just been completed, I think, on the site. So it is now progressing. And you can see the two sheds, which are all the remains of two 19th century dockyards. It's worth walking around there, though, because on the edge of Convoys Wharf, you've got the 18th century master shipwright's house, which you can just see above the high wall. It's a private property and it's all fenced off, but you can just about make it out. And if it's okay with you, Hazel, I'll put some photographs on of basically what is a building site, but it shows you where the Tudor dockyards were.
Yeah, of course.
And then at Woolwich, there's a bit, in a way, there's a bit more to see. Again, nothing Tudor, but when you walk along that part of Woolwich on the riverside, there are a couple of 19th century dry docks, which are now filled with water. You can see a 17th century clock tower, and you can also see some of the 18th century walls of the naval dockyard. And I think a lot of people get confused between the, which is quite understandable, between the dockyard and then the Royal Arsenal. So the Royal Arsenal, there's quite a lot left of the 18th and 19th centuries, which has been redeveloped over the past 20 or so years. But the dockyard was before you came to the Arsenal. There's a huge amount of history there. There's also a kind of what looks like a little fort at Woolwich, which again is a 19th century construction and was possibly used for training marines there. So there's a bit to see.
I might add those photos in the show notes as well.
Okay, good.
So let's get into this age of innovation then. So what brought about these changes?
Yeah, well, the key thing is we've been talking about Henry as the first person to have a standing navy, and this is partly just because he's involved militarily, but it also reflects a fundamental change in naval architecture, which also leads to the importance of these dockyards for maintaining the ships. And that is that in the Middle Ages, if you wanted to create a warship, you could do it quite quickly because you would take a merchant ship and you would add a big wooden castle to the back and the front of the ship. And these wooden castles, these superstructures, were basically used by archers and crossbowmen to fire down on other enemy ships. And when they, with the introduction of gunnery, they're basically an addition to the bows and arrows. So the guns are fairly small and light, and they can't really do damage to a ship's structure, but they're used to try and kill people and possibly do some damage to the rigging as well. And then the key development into creating standing navies is the development of the dedicated warship. And this is because the guns become a lot bigger and you can begin to entertain the idea of having guns with sufficient power that they will actually damage the structure of a ship. And the Portuguese are the first people to mount big guns on ships. But in England, the crucial development comes with the launch of the Mary Rose. And the Mary Rose is launched she's built in 1509. I might have been begun in Henry VII's reign, at the very end of it. But she is the first English ship to mount guns on her waistline, on the deck above the orlop deck. So the orlop deck is the lowest deck in a ship, and she had two heavy guns on either side. And not only have you got big guns in the waistline, the other crucial development is you've got I was going to say modern gun ports, but I'm thinking of sort of a Nelsonic type of ship where you have a square hole in the ship with a hatch over the top. And in theory, you can begin to contemplate doing structural damage to other ships. Now, because you've got these guns in the waist of the ship and you're no longer able to convert merchantmen, for the first time really you've got dedicated warships, and they are ships that aren't very good for being used as merchantmen. Before this date, not only could you convert merchantmen into warships, but obviously you could convert them back again. And the kings, if they were interested in naval affairs, they would have a sort of small fleet of their own ships, and they would hire those out. And one of the targets for hiring them out would be merchants who wanted to use them. So with these, beginning with the Mary Rose, you get these modern in the sense of ships that are dedicated to fighting. And they are permanently there, and you need to look after them. And so hence the need for a lot of these dockyards.
So you've mentioned Portsmouth, but why specifically the River Thames?
Yeah, so we've said that Portsmouth was developed by Henry the Seventh. And I think one reason why Henry VIII was keen on the Thames was simply that it was further away from potential enemies. So Portsmouth alternates really with the Thames dockyards. When England is at war, Portsmouth is the forward base from which the ships are dispatched. But otherwise, it's the Thames yards that are the main yards, and it's Deptford that's by far and away the largest dockyard in the 16th century. And I think it's partly to do with strategy, just being further away from the enemy. But the Thames has a lot of advantages. In the middle of Deptford and Woolwich, you've got Greenwich, and Greenwich is where one of Henry VIII's palaces is. So it's very convenient for him to be involved and to keep an eye on things. And also with ships, you need an awful lot of material. You need a lot of material to provision them, and you also need a lot of materials when you want to construct them. When you want to construct them, you need a ready supply of timber, and the ships, the main structure is made of oak, and you're fairly near to decent supplies of timber from Kent. And in particular in southeast London, there is now an area known as Pett's Wood. That is a 16th century name. I think the name's a bit later than Henry VIII's reign, but the Petts were a dynasty of shipbuilders who happened to own the land there. And in addition to that, you need to be able to draw on a supply of skilled labour. There was already some shipbuilding at Greenwich, at Woolwich and at Deptford. You need to draw on a supply of labour. London's quite an easy, convenient place for getting people from. And you also need to be able to victual the ships. And London is really the only place in England which has got the large markets whereby you can get all the produce that you needed when you were sending ships on voyages. And even when the ships are sent from places like Portsmouth, from bases that aren't on the Thames, all of these goods tend to be sent out from London. And you're talking huge amounts of salted fish, salted beef, ship's biscuit, fresh water, and above all, beer. And then for the repair and construction of ships, again, on the construction side, it's not just oak. You also need other timber, and that timber will be imported, and London is a very convenient place to import stuff from. So you need spruce and fir. You need lots and lots of nails, which can be made locally. You need huge amounts of sailcloth, which is imported, and also ropes, which are imported. They had in the 15th century, they had made a lot of rope in England in around Dorset, but in Henry VIII's reign, they increasingly import it from the Baltic, presumably just simply because it's a lot cheaper. And you need huge amounts of rope. I mean, a ship itself could easily take 20 miles of rope. And so London is extremely convenient because it's a big market, but also it's a very easy, convenient place to import goods to. One should also mention there are a couple of disadvantages to the Thames. One is that if you were unlucky and you were in the Thames estuary and trying to make your way into London, if the winds were unfavourable, you could be stuck for weeks. So that's a huge disadvantage. The other disadvantage is because the Thames is a river, at the area we're talking about, Deptford and Woolwich, the water is a mixture of, it's brackish, it's a mixture of seawater and fresh water, and fresh water will rot timbers a lot more quickly.
So you said that we've got a long history here, but why did it finally all end?
Yeah, so we mentioned earlier that the end date for this is 1869. And actually, can I just say that whilst I was saying there's not a great deal to see of the Tudor dockyards, there is a reasonable amount to see of the later dockyards. And in particular, near Deptford, you've got the late 18th century victualling yards, which are very impressive. It's only a fraction remains of the original, but it's very dramatic. And yeah, they expand massively in the 18th century, huge industrial complex, but it all comes to an end in 1869. And it comes to an end for two reasons. One is the Thames is constantly silting up. They can deal with that. They can dredge the Thames, but it's an inconvenience. And the other thing is that by this time, the main ships are just too big to use the Thames, and it becomes very inconvenient.
Okay, fascinating. Thank you, Ian.
Oh, my pleasure, Hazel.
So if you haven't listened to the previous episode with Ian talking about the port of London in the Tudor period, then that is number 95. And that went down really, really well with our audience.
Yeah, good. I mean, I find it really, that subject of the London as a port, I find really interesting.
Oh, brilliant. And this is nice to add layers of knowledge onto that.
Yeah, and it's good to do something about the Tudors again, isn't it?
Yeah, firm favourite. Thanks, Ian.
Okay, my pleasure, Hazel.
That's all for now. But if you'd like to know more about Tudor London and its history, then go to londonguidedwalks.co.uk/history/Tudor. And that's also where you could sign up to be the first to hear about my brand new book, Tudor Palaces of London. Until next time.